Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Rahul, and I am your host for our global weekly Awaken Call. Today, our guest speaker is none other than the amazing Mr. Keith McHenry, someone who really embodies the theme of today's call, which is abundance and cooperation towards peace and justice. In a few minutes, our moderator, Aria Coopersmith, will engage in a deep dialogue with Keith. And at the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing where we invite all reflections and questions. Again, this week's theme, as I shared earlier, is abundance and cooperation towards peace and justice. Our speaker this week says that notwithstanding our climate crisis, political crisis, and economic crisis, quote, I still believe the human spirit is at a point of global transformation. My 36 years of sharing vegan meals under the banner Food Not Bombs has shown me that people can rise up and change society. So the thought is, how have your experiences with serving others helped you shift to a frame of abundance and help trigger broader change?
What a great question. That's beautiful. Okay.
Yeah, and of course, we've got the pleasure of our remarkable moderator, Aria Coopersmith, today, who I thought we could start by asking him questions to sort of kick off our circle. Aria, of course, is another exemplar of this theme as the founder of One World Life, which is a community of global citizens that have a shared vision of supporting a course of change for humanity. He does this by hosting wisdom circles, which are mostly done by video conference, where people around the world are able to gather and share inspiration, wisdom, knowledge, support, resources, and more. Aria is also the author of a book called Holy Beggars, which chronicles his own journey with the rabbi and musician Shlomo Carlebach in 1960 San Francisco. It's widely regarded as the community and the house of love and prayer that they built together became a new chapter in American Judaism. Aria also holds an MA in humanistic psychology and was ordained as a Jewish spiritual teacher. Him and his wife, Wendy, also convene the Coastside Torah Circle, where people of different backgrounds come together to study the sacred Jewish text in a format where the circle itself is actually the teacher. So we're so delighted to have Aria with us today in conversation with Keith. Aria, you've been doing a lot of this work around abundance and cooperation towards peace and justice, particularly with all of this interfaith work that you've done. I'm curious about what your reflection is and your experiences are from so many years of how this kind of service actually triggers a shift towards abundance, which in turn ripples towards broader systemic change.
Well, thank you, Rahul, for that generous introduction. And you know, as I'm approaching today's conversation and thinking about abundance, I'm thinking about Keith's situation right now. There he is standing on the campus of the SoCal Veg Fest at Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa, and all of those people around him setting up volunteers, and this has been part of a, as I understand it, a Food Not Bombs kind of college tour where they're showing up in different colleges and bringing people together. And you know, Raul, when you're asking me about abundance, what and how service triggers that, what's really fascinating to me is how service brings together, can bring together people from all over to do more service, who bring together people to do more service, who bring together more people. And I'm just fascinated by that process. So I'm looking forward to our conversation this morning. And I'd like to just say a few words initially introducing Keith. As Raul had mentioned, he's driven by this amazing vision of how food, not bombs, can change people in society, and this has been going on for 35 years. Keith's work in this started in 1980 when he was a college student. He was at an anti-nuclear protest, and he saw this sign, which some of us from those days may remember. It will be a great day when the schools get all the money they need and the Air Force has to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. That was sort of an iconic saying. And Keith set out to make that a reality. Food, not bombs, today, according to our bio write-up of him, has over 1,000 chapters worldwide. And these are self-organizing by volunteers around the world. That structure is a particularly powerful because it can keep going. It doesn't need any kind of central organization or fundraising or anything like that. Food Not Bombs salvages surplus food that would otherwise go to waste. They prepare it. They serve it for free in parks, in front of post offices, on street corners, at protests. And they also distribute flyers and encourage people who come to get involved in conversations and connections. And think about being part of a new emerging society where people are dealing with industrial agriculture, military spending, poverty, and thinking about a post-capitalist world. He founded Food Not Bombs in San Francisco and then other places around the world. He was arrested so many times that in 1995 he was actually facing a life in prison because of California's three strikes law. And that's when Amnesty International got involved and adopted his case, and people around the world rallied to his support. And as the news spread, it spread the movement. So anyway, Keith, I want to thank you again for for setting aside the time in the midst of this gathering that you're setting up for now to be part of our gathering.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Now, so I'm all set up, and now I'm leisurely walking around looking at all the beautiful booths and all the people here, and really cool to be in the middle of seeing all these people set up their vegan booths and so on while I'm talking to you all on the phone. It's just amazing.
So how did you wind up there? What brought you over to that particular campus for this weekend?
Well, what I have been on tour kind of on and off since 1994 when I got my first arrest that became the three strikes case. And so, you know, not unusual for me to be on tour. And I was actually speaking at the National Animal Rights Conference and tabling at that in L.A. I do that every year, put on by FARM. And I met these organizers. Their booth was across the way, and they were advertising the Southern California Veg Fest. And they invited me to come speak and do a booth there. So that's how I ended up here. And you know, when you do Food Not Bombs, serendipity endlessly happens. And so you end up, you know, if you say yes, you end up going all over the world and doing all kinds of amazing things you'd never expect. And that's the case here.
Amazing. So what's, can you tell us, you know, how much travel do you actually do? What's your typical week like, your typical month like these days?
Well, it depends on the season and the year and so on. I can sometimes spend all of September, October, and November traveling, and then to usually universities and schools in North America. And then I'll go south either for December and January to speak in Mexico, or I might go to Indonesia, the Philippines at that time. Occasionally I'll go to Europe. Sometimes I'll go to Africa. So fortunately, I've been able to travel the world, and it's also very funny because sometimes I spent time in Nairobi and in Kenya. Everyone wants to know if I saw the beautiful elephants and everything. Well, as it turns out, all I saw, not all I saw, what I saw was these amazing slums that were huge and amazing children that were really grateful that they had food to eat and that they got to participate in workshops and so on that we put on. So I've got to see that part of the whole world, like from the slums of Nairobi and like some of the most hardcore parts of Nigeria to places in like Iceland. I was in Iceland right after the revolution. So, you know, it's been really magical. And then to see how the Food Not Bombs people, you know, do their work with based on the three basic principles, the principles being that the food is always vegan, or in the case of some pastries and breads, vegetarian, that there's no leaders or rulers or headquarters, that each group is autonomous and makes decisions using the consensus process to include not only everyone in the community that wants to help, but to invite people that might need the food to participate in guiding the local chapter. And then the third is that we're not a charity, but that we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action to change society so that no one has to live in the streets or go hungry or face the ravages of environmental destruction or war. And so this sets us aside from, you know, like groups like the Salvation Army or things, which in America, many people, you know, will equate us with saying, oh, yeah, you're like Second Harvest. My church gives out food. And that's great that their church gives out food. But really, we'd like to create abundance. You know, the thing that as we're starting out with, 45% of the food in the United States, and this is also true in Europe and Australia and many other parts of the world, is just discarded before it even gets to the table. And so there's all this food that we could eat, that, you know, share. And we like to show that abundance by just bringing out a huge amount of food onto the streets and overwhelming the public with the idea they can take as much as they want.
So, Keith, you've made this distinction that's interesting to me. You said we're not a charity, we're a nonviolent direct action community, right? Do I have that right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
So what's the distinction between a charity and the kind of community you guys are?
Well, the distinction is that the people that are eating with us are us. We are not separated from the people that come to eat. And that's one major distinction. And then the other is that, you know, we don't have this perspective of that the poor will always be with us and it's their fault that they're poor and we're above them and handing out the food and keeping them alive and so on. We're actually coming from the perspective that we can change society so that no one has to go without. And that's where the term that I often use, a post-capitalist society, comes in. Because, you know, there's no balance in a society where you always have to increase the profits, increase the use of resources, keep, you know, a linear kind of economic and political system that the United States and that much of the world exists in. And really, you know, the Earth is a finite, closed ecological system. And it makes a lot of sense that we live in harmony with one another and that we live in harmony with the Earth and with our own sense of spirit, and that we, you know, live in that manner. And that really is what's going to pull us through over the, you know, coming generations. And you could see, for instance, in the water protectors over in up in North Dakota, you know, how it's such a clash of cultures where people are trying to live in harmony with the environment and protect the water at the same time that the people that are seeking to increase their power and their profits are waging a military assault on Native people on their own land and are, you know, really using a huge amount of violence against peaceful people. And so that the food not bombs can represent that.
That struggle that you just mentioned is a great, I think a great illustration of your vision. The quote that Raul mentioned right at the beginning, I'm curious about this. You know, you said I still believe that the human spirit is at the point of global transformation.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about that. Why now? Why is the human spirit at the point of global transformation now at this time as opposed to some other time?
Well, oddly enough, I was a big proponent of the 100th monkey theory, which was something very big in the anti-nuclear movement in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And that's a study where at some point, once the 100th monkey had learned to wash his food in the river, all the monkeys started doing it, even ones that weren't in that immediate vicinity, and that it was just a consciousness that traveled the world. And I think we have that kind of happening now. In part, the odd thing is the, you know, the web and the internet and so on, that technology, which on one hand is very destructive. For instance, many slaves in Congo and children have to mine the minerals that make it possible for these cell phones. There was a huge amount of coal being burned and nuclear power and so on to create the electricity to have the World Wide Web. But it kind of linked us up. So that's one unusual and positive thing. Although I have to say they were like the 100th monkey before food not bombs started becoming global, before the web and before the internet, or before it was popularly used. It was only used in the military and academic circles. And so there was a consciousness already happening between people. When people saw us get arrested in 88, they read maybe about it in the newspaper, or they heard about it word of mouth, and they were so outraged they started their own food not bombs, and they figured out how to do it just by the, you know, but without there even being a publication yet about how to do it. And but now, well, I think we're at a situation where that's so obvious to many, many people that the systems are not working in anywhere. The systems of power, like, you know, the electoral system in the United States, you know, where it's appears to be a greater and greater farce the closer we get to the election, or the climate change crisis, where you have Katrina and then Sandy and then cyclones throughout Southeast Asia and droughts and then you have the housing foreclosure crisis. And so all these different things keep building to like a higher consciousness that we need to really work together, that we need to, stop war, stop the environmental destruction. And so many people see that. So one example of why I think the evidence of a transformation is when food not bombs started in 80, most people just thought that we are vegans and we must have been like Hindus or something, and they had no idea, you know, they never heard of people like ourselves, you know, sharing free, you know, eating or sharing free anything. You know, some people might have heard of the Black Panthers or something, or the Great Depression soup kitchens. But now, you know, the people, you know, here it is, a huge vegan fest with hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah.
All over the world organizing these festivals and are vegan, and you've got vegan magazines. So that, you know, it's slow work, but it's being steady. And I think that consciousness, because, you know, for Food Not Bombs, we were trying to link the idea that if you're for peace, you must be for peace with other species and peace with the earth. You can't be just against war and eat meat. You can't be just against war
sounds,
coal mining.
It sounds like, in your vision, the kind of coming apart of the current order and the global capitalist system and so on, is that coming apart is happening hand in hand with the emergence of a new consciousness, a new way of relating to each other and to the earth.
Yeah. So, I think that there is that happening where people all over the, you know, there is a coming together of all these things. And, so, you know, we're really excited about that. I think people, you know, it's really, there's a combination of this being a worldwide phenomenon that's just amazing, and this personal thing that is going on when you go out and share the food on the streets. And that's, to me, it's like a celebration. And I know, like, say in Santa Cruz, where I do a lot of the, you know, that's my sort of one of my home bases, that in Taos, New Mexico. Both places, when I'm at the meals, and this is everywhere, but particularly since I do Santa Cruz like twice a week often when I'm there, it's like a huge celebration. All these people are out there, you know, enjoying the food, seeing this huge amount of food, but also engaged in conversations about what is it that we can do to change society. And it's just remarkable, you know, the energy. And this is like, you know, many of the people, you think, wow, they're living in a sleeping bag under a, in a doorway, trying just to get from point A to point B every day without being harassed by the police too bad. And yet at the same time, they too are joining in this vision of making the world a better place. And, you know, it's just magical. It's magical. So you have this, you know, the personal, and I know that this is true for many Food Not Bombs people. That's why they will do it for, in some cases, decades, because it just was so amazing, their experience, the first time they went out with the food and stood out there and were sharing meals with people and had this connection with the people and saw what abundance really, the message of abundance. And it's just, it's amazing. So it gives you some sense of hope.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of social movements, you know, I noticed when I was a young person doing political organizing before I did Food Not Bombs, I would, you know, you'd have a big rally. It'd be real exciting. There'd be great speakers. There might be a band or something. It was a really nice connection with everybody. But, boy, you add the abundance of free vegan food to that mix, and it's really inspiring. So
what's striking me in listening to what you're saying is that this movement that's involving so many people and making changes in the world, that you're really bringing it down to the personal level, that when someone shows up and is involved in this celebration of food and abundant food for everybody, that it's very personal, and that personal quality changes people. Yeah?
Yes, it does. And you know, there was a book called Recipes for Disaster by Crime Think, and the woman, interestingly enough, called us a gateway to activism. Well, part of it is that it touches your heart so strongly to be in that environment that it transforms you, and you just start, it's hard to turn back. And generally speaking, it's such a positive experience. I'm sure there's some people that had a difficult time and weren't so happy, or they burned their hand in the or something like that, and it was like somewhat negative. But for the most part, what I hear is people they're changed. And back to that original, how I knew about coming to this, how I got invited to this Veg Fest. When I first went to Animal Rights Conference, I was not really connected to the Animal Rights Conference. It cost like $100 to go, those kind of things. It was in a hotel. I was a grassroots activist. I very rarely came across those, went to those kind of things. But they invited me to speak. And I was, here I've been vegan all these years. I've been handing out vegan food on the street, trying to encourage people, influenced by Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Moore LePay and others that, ending world hunger and was being plant-based was essential, and that was one part. And then also being in harmony with your guest war, how could you be for, the horrible things that happen to animals. And I had a lot of experience with both having to kill roosters myself as a youngster and going to a turkey processing plant and so on. So to me, I saw what a cruel thing meat was. But then I show up at this event, like after, it must have been 2005 or something like that, and maybe 2004. And all these people who I looked up to and thought were amazing, animal rights activists I'd read about, seen them on TV and so on, go, wow, you're the grandfather of the animal rights movement. You're the grandfather of vegan food. I'm like, how can that be? And they said, because I happened to walk by your table, or I've listened to Propagandhi, the punk band, and they talked about food, not bombs. And so I started doing food, not bombs. And I was like, wow, you just don't know what kind of influence a little project like this could have.
Awesome how that's happened. I have a question for you about something you were just saying. Going back to the experience of individuals in the movement, I'm probably about 10 years or so older than you, and I'm recalling, probably more than that, maybe 15, but I'm recalling the movements in the 60s that I was involved with. I was also involved with the anti-nuclear movement and the protest against the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, and so on. And one of the things that happened there was that a lot of us were motivated by visions of a better world and the courage to act and do something about it. What many of us weren't so strong on was knowledge about ourselves. And so a lot of unconscious stuff happened. Women were treated often in a second-class way. People got involved in their own ideas and became pretty defensive and egotistical about their ideas. And people really weren't working on themselves so much in an inner way, and that caused all kinds of mischief. I'm wondering, in the Food Not Bombs movement and the social movements you're involved with, is there a way that besides working on the world that people are also working on themselves? How does that happen?
Well, that can happen in many different ways. A great many of the young people are anarchists and have an anarchist philosophy. And so they somewhat reject like organized religion and things of that nature.
Right.
So so you do have, but then in that community of people, which, is a substantial number of young people, they work on themselves in other ways. So, for instance, they will, they seek empowerment and being strong. And so they will have like meetings and workshops on things against sexism, racism, homophobia, ageism. And they really will work very hard on that And their philosophy, since it's an idea of being in the Phunan Bombs world, I would not say this is the case necessarily in the whole anarchist world, yeah, of compassion, that it there's a real deep effort to try to be in a line in this personal way. At the same time, there's also quite a number of people that are also, you know, are from different spiritual backgrounds, you know, who may have meditated or do meditate now. There's, you know, or have a combination of that and anarchism. The DIY idea that grew out of Phunan Bombs and the other social movements that started at the time of Phunan Bombs has meant that people do seek a way of bettering themselves, of having some kind of balance between their inner world and the service world. And the service itself kind of encourages that almost automatically, because you're out there with these people, you end up engaging. I mean, this is what, the longer and longer I share food in any community. So I did 10 years in San Francisco. I become like personal friends with people that are living on the streets and with their demons and their efforts to maybe stop using drugs or their struggle to get housing or their, you know, many Vietnam vets that are struggling with Agent Orange and things like that. So you end up, that kind of environment for Phunan Bombs activists really gets you in touch with things. And even, and a lot of times, you know, the people eating with us will go, God bless you. And even if that makes the young person kind of recoil at the actual words of that, you can't hear that kind of thing so much, so year after year, without seeing that there is some kind of deep connection that you are having with these people, that it means so much to them. And I think a lot of people who might reject, you know, mainstream religions and stuff, and who hear this, and people, you know, living on the streets are used to eating at missions and so on, and that, you know, we live in a very Christian culture, it becomes like you transcend that, you know, it doesn't, and I think a lot of the people, you know, really seek some kind of authentic, one of the things I always hear is that the young people like the Phunan Bombs because it's authentic. You actually are out there with real people doing stuff, and your life is being enmeshed with them. And I think that, you know, and this is like a, you know, when I say Christian culture, that of course is the United States, but, you know, I hear this when I'm in Muslim culture with Phunan Bombs, and, you know, they might not be so into the mainstream Muslim community, and they're, you know, in Indonesia, for instance, but because that's the context that people who seek food often find food is through churches. But so it's a really interesting mixture of rejecting
these religions. Sounds like what you're saying is that the practice of service itself becomes a kind of practice of inner transformation, regardless of what beliefs you may have.
Correct. And I think there might, you know, people do build like a non-hierarchical, non-exploitive philosophy. But there is like this heart that people also have as a result of doing this service. And I think that, you know, it's like a whole new direction, I think. Then what happened, like, you know, because I was very young during the 60s, but I still, you know, went to protests and, you know, I was very inspired by, you know, by the Martin Luther King and things like that. You know, I didn't really know how to access that. I would see hippies go by and be all into that. So it is really, really interesting. And, you know, and I do know, you know, like I'm almost 60, so I have some connection to the, you know, to the Marxist-Leninist struggles, the Maoist struggles, things like that, and also even in the late 70s, I would be often encouraged to speak out for women's rights in the peace and social justice movement by my feminist colleagues, so who were frustrated that the men were just running over everybody and speaking.
Well, thinking back on those good old days, I'm curious. You know, I want to ask you if you can share a story with us from the early days when you were just getting started with Food Not Bombs, and what that was like.
Yeah, so the when I started, I was an art student at Boston University, and I was had figured out this really cool thing where I could do a work in the mornings as a produce worker at this organic food store, because I was already totally into organics and vegan and all that. So I wanted a job that I did before class that was aligned with my vision. And so I had, the store became Whole Foods, but its name at the time was Bread and Circus, and it was in Central Square, Cambridge. And I people aren't buying all my produce. This is terrible. So I don't want to throw it away. And I ended up with two or three cases of wilted lettuce and odd-shaped apples and things like that. And so I'd start taking them to the projects about 3-4 blocks away on Portland Avenue. And across the street were these vacant lots behind MIT, and they started to build these labs, and one of them was Draper Lab, where they're designing nuclear weapons. And the people that I was giving the food to were telling me about how they were designing nuclear weapons over there. We'd talk about the building and what they were doing. And it occurred to me that, you know, here are these people, like, complained about their plumbing and complained about, you know, that their heaters didn't work. But there's a brand new glass building, 5-story building across the street from them. And they were desperate to get all my food that no one would buy. And they're excited to get it and grateful. And so it occurred to me that we should have, like, food and not bombs. And hence the name came about from that, and a combination of that and me and some graffiti that I was doing outside a grocery store, say money for food, not for bombs. And so that was the first, that was one aspect. And then another aspect was that I was going up to the anti-nuclear protests up at Seabrook, New Hampshire, and with Clamshell Alliance. And I'd go up there and, you know, we would get arrested and so on. And one of my friends, Brian Feigenbaum, got arrested and on serious assault charges. And so we decided on May 24th protest, we decided that we would organize like a defense committee. And one of the things we wanted to do was to raise money, so we'd do bake sales. And we'd make like $4 or $5 outside of the student union, or we'd make, you know, $10 in Harvard Square or something. And it was like, wow, we're never really putting together a defense, chest out of all this. And at that same time, I had an old van, and I, like a lot of hippies in the day, and I was moving this family. I used my van as a moving truck called Smooth Move. And they were throwing out a poster that was mounted on cardboard called, as you said before, wouldn't it be a beautiful day if the schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. And
yeah.
So I took that idea and we went to and got military uniforms and went out on the streets and started telling people we're trying to buy a bomber, help us buy one of our brownies or cookies or something. And then the final thing that becomes Food Not Bombs is that we thought, wow, the street theater is working really well. People really take to it. It catches them off guard, and they want to find out about our vegan cookies and so on. So why don't we do this? We will dress up as hobos, and we'll do because we found out that the Bank of Boston's board members were also the people building the nuclear power station and nuclear bombs in the air, and they were all interlocking board of directors. So we thought, okay, we'll go to the stockholders meeting at the Federal Reserve Bank South Station, dressed up as hobos, and we'll have a big pot of soup out of the food I'm recovering from the grocery store. So that night, we were like, wow, we're not going to really have a line of people like in the Great Depression unless we find some people that want this food. And it's such beautiful soup, it's a shame, you know, we'll never be able to eat it all. So we went to the shelter and Pine Street Inn, and I gave a little speech, and the guys were like, oh, this is great, a protest like the 60s. And the next thing you know, they all showed up at lunch, and there was, 50 to 75 people from the shelter, plus business people and stockholders and our friends, and we're all, like, eating outside of this stockholders meeting. And it was just so magical that we decided to quit our jobs and do nothing but this. And the actual homeless guys said there was no food for people in Boston at that time. There weren't soup kitchens and stuff happening anymore because, you know, it had been a long time since the Great Depression.
And you know what I'm struck with is the imagery of some of the parts of the story of the inequitable distribution of resources. The military gets the big shiny building, and here are all these people whose plumbing doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera. And so you're creating the space where there's resources happen are shared by everybody.
Yeah.
Another thing that really strikes me is your sense of street theater. It seemed like so much of what you were doing to get things started was about street theater.
Yeah, and we were super influenced. We had friends that were did theater games and were involved in the Living Theater out of, at that time, New York City. That's actually where they had been on and off for most of their existence. And so the Living Theater had this philosophy that was really amazing, and part of it was that the public itself walking by would be part of the theater, that it would be not clear who the actors are and who are not the actors, and that hence the name Living Theater. And we were very influenced by that. And other groups that were that people might have heard of were Bread and Puppet were also influenced by years before by the Living Theater. Living Theater had been around since the 50s, and they're very active, for instance, in the Vietnam War protests and so on. So we really had like a theater and background. And as an artist, I was also, you know, I had this experience where right around that same time, my art teacher said, oh, go down to the galleries and look at the art galleries and see about your future. You'll be selling your paintings and sculptures at these art galleries. And I went down to some in Newbury Street, which is like Madison Avenue of Boston. And, I see these like what we called yuppies at the time looking at this painting that was not actually very good. And mentioning that the artist's artwork was increasing in value, 7.8% annually, and it was a really good investment. And
uh-huh.
I just heard that, and it made me cringe. And then around that same time, I hear this woman on a milk cart when I'm eating lunch at the Boston Commons talking about nuclear war, and her name was Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Oh,
I was like, wow, that's what I should do. I should have my art be public and about something that is meaningful. And so then that connected, and I was already into trying to bring punk to America from England. And I was trying to, I want to create like a whole art cultural movement that speaks to the ideas that I think are so important.
Yeah.
And so
by the way, I noticed that I bet that on the Food Not Bombs website that artwork there must be your artwork.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay. I would encourage any of us listening when you go to Food Not Bombs to check it out. Hey, I'm noticing we're getting close to the top of the hour, Keith, and we're going to open it up to everyone on the call. I had another question before we get there. And that is, you've been at this for 36 years. and you've seen a lot. What can you share with us a time that was a particularly personal challenge? It's like, I'm curious, what was your biggest personal challenge on this journey?
Well, as you can probably imagine, the facing 25 to life was extremely stressful. And part of what went on in that period of time was increased brutality. So something that had physical impact and emotional impact for quite some time was I was captured by the police. You know, I'd get bailed out, and then I'd be on the streets, and the police would pick me up. And they take me to police headquarters, which I actually didn't know until, when I would get there. They'd take me in a van where I couldn't see out. And they'd take me upstairs. They'd rip my clothes off. They'd lift me by my arms and legs and rip my tendons and ligaments and yell at me obscenities in this big, dark room, some people kicking me in the side and the head and so on. And then they'd stuff me in a little cage that was hanging from the ceiling, and I'd stay there for 3 days, and then they eventually let me out at 3 a.m. with just my pants into the cold, rainy streets of San Francisco. And that's how I learned that I was, you know, they pushed me out into front of 850 Bryant Street, which was the headquarters, and I learned that I was actually in, you know, I could tell over time that you know, in the 3 times this happened, I learned that I was in room 136 on the first floor. And that's where their stress position cage was located, and for San Francisco Police Intelligence Unit. Now, they didn't ask me any questions or anything like that. They just were doing that to terrorize me. And then when I finally got the court case itself was so stressful because they would bring riot police to the courtroom. It didn't seem like there was possibility of a fair trial. You just had the sense that you could end up spending the rest of your life in jail. And I would get transported around. I did a thing called bus therapy for a while because of jail overcrowding, where they transport the prisoners before count and drop them off after count on buses and drive them around the Bay Area, and then you've got to get cavity searches like 10 times a day. So that, you know, you're just like, this is going to be my life. I'm going to be in chains in an orange jumpsuit for the rest of my life, and people will, you know, end up forgetting about me, and, you know, I'll be in some, you know, horrible dystopian world forever.
That's hard to imagine that was 1995 San Francisco, where you were getting that kind of treatment. Why were they so, you know, why so extreme? Why did you represent such a big threat to them?
Well, this is interesting. In 1988, when we first got arrested, we were arrested on August 15th, and through into September, there was like 94 arrests at Golden Gate Park. And then that Thanksgiving, we get, you know, a number of volunteers would come back from Thanksgiving vacation and say that a National Guards person had seen them wave the Food Not Bombs button with the purple fist and carrot, and say, oh, wow, we just studied that group in counterterrorism school. That's America's most hardcore terrorist group. And then we started getting indications that Chevron and Bank of America and Bechtel Corporation and Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and so on, were concerned that the increased number of homeless people and the fact that Food Not Bombs was starting up in different cities was a threat possibly to their profits, and that people would demand that money would be spent on things like food, education, healthcare, and things like that, and diverted away from military spending. And so we would hear rumor of that, and we heard a lot of, I have to say, there was like, I think, 14, 15 reports that the National Guard had commented that we are America's most hardcore terrorist group, and they'd studied us over Thanksgiving vacation. And that's from places as far away as like in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. and San Francisco. So what seemed to be like kind of a national aspect of that weekend for National Guard's people. And then in 2009, in April 2009, I was on tour and I spoke at Princeton. And I go back and I turn on C-SPAN, and there's a lecture. But who's more dangerous, the people that share vegan food in the streets or Al-Qaeda? And at the end, their conclusion was that the people that share the vegan meals are friendly, they're empowering, the people are really attracted to what they're doing, and that as a result, there could be economic impact where money will be diverted from military spending towards education, healthcare, and other social services, and therefore we would not have the financial means to defend the country from enemies, and that made the vegan meals more threatening, more dangerous.
I love it. What a perverse and sincere compliment.
It really is, and I'm actually, if anybody wants to dedicate time to finding that videotape, I can give you the dates and when and the hour that I watched it. And I've called C-SPAN over and over again, but I just happened to tune in both times after they introduced the speaker. And they actually catalog their video by the names of the speakers. And I believe they were speaking at Fletcher School of Diplomacy, and I believe they were State Department officials. So anybody wants to dedicate a few months of trying to find this video, which it must exist. I can't imagine they would have erased it, at least every copy. It would be really super helpful because I've been a woman named Liz Tadich has been working on a Food on Bombs documentary for almost 15 years now, and part of her reason for not finishing it is she's not getting enough video about what the opposition feels about Food Not Bombs, and so she keeps getting criticism that it looks like a promo for Food Not Bombs rather than an interesting documentary.
Well, maybe we can send out a reminder. We send out an email to everyone after the call, so we could, I think, include that as a reminder. Just before I'm going to turn this back over to Rahul, I just want to ask you one question, if you can respond to this, and that is, over the years that you've been doing this work, is there a particular personal lesson that has come to you? You know, what keeps you going? What keeps you focused? What keeps you on target? What keeps you optimistic? Something that you've learned as a result of your experience.
Wow, that's really, I could go on and on for that. So one of the things that is sticking to the basics of your, you know, of your idea and doing it over and over again for a long, long time. So just from the lesson of political organizing and global transformation, that's one thing I've learned. Now, so that's just like a practical strategic idea. But as far as me continuing to do it, I think it's built into the Food Not Bombs. Every aspect of it, there's so many aspects of it that are rewarding. So, for instance, the personal relationships and the celebration of doing the meal, that's enough to you just keep wanting to come back and do that, because you see people that have, you know, that like they don't get good food, or that's hard to find food, or people coming to you that have not eaten in 4 days and are like blown away that they're going to get all the food they want and there's no limitations. These kind of things, those that will certainly keep you going for a long time. And then the challenge of, you know, doing something with no resources. You know, that was part of the whole idea of this, is we wanted a model that could be done by anybody, no matter how wealthy or how poor, and that it would be without limits. So that challenge has been really interesting. But I think there's also some things that are deeper, which help keep me going. One of them is I grew up in the national parks, and my grandfather was a park ranger, a naturalist, and my father was a naturalist, and then ultimately I was for a short while. And in growing up in the wilderness and with people who knew about natural history and anthropology and so on, I had these amazing transformational experiences, and two of them that I think were at the core, which always keep me going. First of all, my father gave me Walden by Thoreau, and I just learned to read. I have dyslexia, so I read the short part first. In those days, the edition, I think the Penguin edition, had the lecture and by Thoreau on why he refused to pay taxes for the Mexican War. So I read that first, and that really changed me. And then, of course, I became really, wow, I got to read Walden. I read Greek mythology and everything that is inspired out of Walden. And then the other one was that we would go from the kindergarten to the third grade. I lived at the Grand Canyon. And my grandfather was very close to the elders at Old Araby, which is the oldest community in North America. It's over 4,000 years old. And they would do a snake dance every season, and you know, once a year. And I would go to the snake dance. And in those days, we were the only white family that would go. And I would see this thing that had happened for 4,000 years in that very same piece of land. And the energy of that was really, God, just so affected me.
Yeah, and beautiful. Time, yeah, there's so many things, obviously, that weave into your life and keep you going, and certainly a lot for us to think about. Raul, I'm going to turn this over to you at this point.
Sure. Thank you, Arye. Keith, we do have a question that's in the queue right now. Let me just go
Great.
To that.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Brother Keith, for all the inspiration, and Brother Arya and Rahul for holding the container to be moved to the core as someone. I have so many things in thread that I would like to follow, but in the intention to also leave space for other folks, we'll try to be brief. But I really want to touch 3 points. The first is on gratitude. The second is on revolutionary nonviolence. And the third, I think you were touching on that thread on Gandhi and Thoreau. So the first point, Brother Keith, is as someone that directly benefited from your revolutionary ripples of love by being fed these delicious vegan meals many, many, many times at People's Park in Berkeley by the Food Nonviolence volunteers. Really, thank you for that, because I know that many, many folks have been nourished deeply by your efforts. And so like people like me, many, many more that you don't know. So as someone, one of those millions that have been benefited, thank you so much.
That's beautiful.
Going. And the part of revolutionary nonviolence, and you say how brutal that torture of the FBI was and continued to be, because you know, if you ask people like Erica Huggins, one of the founders of the Black Panthers, or even just elder Black Panthers, and they were considered also the highest threat to national security for their social programs. And you ask them, the elders again, and they say, well, right now, we were doing that back in the day to have all these clinics and health and food, and now I think it's the same. Like if people are able to be self-reliant, and nowadays, this is the most revolutionary thing to do. And your resilience, and that resilience of Erica too, speaks a lot of what you were saying. So thank you for underscoring the importance of persistence. You know, I encourage everybody that is listening to this call to read your book, latest book, The Anarchist Cookbook. It's not the older version, or even the new version by Brother Keith. And then you say there, in a part of revolutionary nonviolence, you say, our persistence and dedication to nonviolence attracted public support. Our volunteers would not give up, knowing that if we did, future efforts to silence student bombs groups in other cities were more likely. And
the
community of people like Diggers and our amazing brother Tree in the mission, he's always saying that we need to be in continuity of service. And just to finish up, I don't know if anything comes through you, brother, in this kind of rattle of love when you were mentioning Thoreau. Well, there was another person who was highly influenced by Thoreau, and that was, maybe some folks have heard his name, Gandhi. And he said, the very right to live is only afforded to us if we fulfill our duty as citizens of the world. Nationalism is not the highest concept. The highest concept is a world community. So that was Gandhi, and he was highly also by Thoreau. So, you are creating that part of world community with disobeying with great love moment by moment, and really wanted to, again, to thank you. And maybe, I don't know if you could touch right now these very high, very hot issue happening right now with our brothers and sisters of the Lakota Nation and the Standing Rock, and how can we all be in our little way contributing physically or emotionally, spiritually to these efforts, and why not? Maybe we can meet in a tipi as a way, as you say, it's so important, this clash of cultures in a way, that because we are these folks are on the of the FBI sometimes, that we're doing this for their well-being, but they're supporting these death projects. And here on the other side, we are supporting these love life projects. And so maybe we can meet on a teepee on Standing Rock soon to have this conversation, maybe on the Footnote Bombs crew. And so I just want to put all those threads there to see if anything comes to you, but mainly is just an odd gratitude and love for all the incredible work that you and volunteers have done. As you said, you're not serving people, because people are serving themselves too with this effort. So that's what an undocumented and unafraid human being is telling to you all right now. Thank you.
Wow, Pancho. Thank you so much. That's so beautiful. When somebody reads like something that I wrote a while ago, I just go, oh my God, I forgot I wrote that. But it's so deep. And you know what? That inspired me to think, right? I received communications from Olympia, Washington Food Not Bombs, and they're being told that they have to stop sharing food. And they've been sharing food in Olympia for like probably 20 years, and the current crew has been active for 10. And so, not giving up is so important. And I really hear that from the Olympia Food Not Bombs activists, that even though they're being threatened with arrest for trespassing this weekend and for sharing free food in public, they are going to go forward. And at the same time, I just one of our first trucks is leaving from Taos, New Mexico, today to go to Standing Rock. Beautiful. And we have a wood stove, a truckload of wood. We've got army tent that we're taking that way, and of course our cooking equipment. And then you may know Stephen Dunifer, and he and I are working on shipping a 300 watt FM radio station over to Standing Rock, which we should do this weekend. And so these are some, we are
awesome.
In line with, I've been to, I helped organize a Standing Rock vigil in Santa Cruz, and Bobby Castile and Bucky and many other people showed up for that. And that was really powerful. And then I attended the Pueblo, Taos Pueblo organized Standing Rock vigil in the Taos Plaza. I've been to a couple of those, and they held a prayer meeting yesterday and sent off the caravan, which includes our equipment that's going out this morning. And it's just also, we raised money to buy canteens so that people don't use petrochemicals to have water at Sandy Rock, since we're trying to stop the oil and save the
water
earth.
Is life. Beautiful.
Yeah, so we have water is life canteens that we are shipping up there and that we have available. I actually have them right here at this Veg Fest for people to buy, which goes back into buying more. And it has the message, it has the water is life, and it has like a way to connect with the movement. And I noticed that there was a huge vigil at the federal building in San Francisco that Martha Burke had emailed photos of me about it yesterday. And so if we can't get to Standing Rock, you know, we need to stand at wherever we are and make make this statement that we want this to end and also to transform our I know you have amazing projects and just doing things like growing our own food. We're experimenting at the Food Not Bombs Free School in Taos with alternative ways of making electricity and you know, permaculture and all kinds of ways of trying to live in harmony with the earth. We do mushroom picking up in the mountains and dry them wild herb collecting and all those things are, if we're all slowly moving in that direction, it's going to have a big impact. And I think, the other thing I think about is the peace aspect, the prayer, being water protectors at Standing Rock.
Totally.
Such a beautiful, I think that we have learned from Wounded Knee. You know, I was the director of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee for 3 years. And the not to mean that some of our defenders and protectors will not end up facing life in prison in the Dakotas. But the thing is to face life in prison knowing in your heart and that the people know in their hearts that you are nonviolent. Is so powerful, and I think that if the authorities try to pull a Leonard Peltier at Standing Rock, they're going to be having that could be really the energy that would undermine their whole ability to continue to exploit the world. So I'm just so inspired by what's happening there. And I wish I could be there myself, and I hope to go there. But I feel like I am there in some ways because there's a Food Not Bombs kitchen there, Food Not Bombs volunteers are going there. And it's good to be making that world, you know, one of the things that there's an attempt to do is to hide the effort at Standing Rock, like by not having it in the mainstream media. But I think many people know that it's happening. Because, you know, of our friends that are sending out videos, we are doing our actions in our communities. I think we will succeed. This could be the last pipeline like Seabrook was for many, many decades, the last nuclear power station.
Yes. So. Well, thank you so much for stressing that point that everybody can get plugged in. Just super briefly, you were saying how everyone can contribute. A couple of days ago when all the water protectors were there and then the police with the tanks were coming and they were beating up people and they were macing teenagers and women and all this is happening and some people have their whole task is just being praying, just being positive energy, positive thoughts. And as soon as they are in this kind of climax of violence coming from the police state, the militarized police and policing right here is like hundreds of police in riot gear, then a herd of bison, a herd of buffalo came, and people were so moved because this is kind of what we're talking about, that we're in different realms, and they're just those galloping. And so the people in law enforcement, you know, these brothers and sisters that we're doing that for that too, that's the nonviolence. We're trying to touch their heart. They're just blown away. They have to stop doing all this madness that they're doing and just pay reverence to these beings that they're coming along. So those prayers and those positive thinking and that embodiment is so important. So once again, brother, I love you very much. Here, using the electron map to spread love, erase borders, and thank you for bringing Toro. I was against they were in the part of what we call Mexico, and that's how they stole this land and killed these brothers and sisters of Native Americans. But here we are, committed to radical love to create a better world. And thank you also, our beloved service space ecosystem, for holding space for having these conversations that are truly revolutionary.
Oh, thank
addressing
you
the
so
course.
Much. That's
thank
beautiful.
You, Pato. I love that you brought up Standing Rock, and it turns out that Keith, of course, is so deeply involved. It already has so much stuff connected there and going on. We do have a question from our web form, and this is from Len Troutman in San Mateo, where he says, "Recently I went into our market's dumpster looking for coffee grounds for our garden. I was amazed to discover vast amounts of slightly blemished or irregular fruits and vegetables, all perfectly edible. I filled up and took home to my wife for a big box of delicious food. Please say more about better ways to prevent such waste."
Well, you know, one of the things I have been corresponding with the senators and the people in France who passed this law that's so amazing, where no food can be thrown away. The food has to be either made into meals to feed to people, provided to animals to eat, or composted. And that's like a countrywide law in France. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, and I think that, so I'm trying to get the person who thought of that law, who first promoted it, to tour the United States. Now, the thing that happens with that, in the United States, is somewhat different. You know, and that it's, you know, France is a smaller place, and the national law in that regard could happen. Here, it might not happen as a national law, but it certainly could happen as city laws, and then like the plastic bag laws and things like that could become ultimately state laws. And if all the states do it, then it would become essentially a national phenomenon. And that, and it's very interesting that that law came about in France, because we were, for instance, in Taos, New Mexico, we have Albertson Smith and Super Save, and then we have the food co-op, Taos Market, and SIDS. The Taos Market, the food co-op, and SIDS will give us everything that they throw out, and it's all organic and it's really beautiful. But the large grocery stores, they actually have the policy of using a trash compactor to destroy all the food. So the produce workers at those three commercial stores are like heartbroken, because they actually come from poor families that could certainly use the food. So that encouraged me to try to start an anti-trash compactor movement against food, which I tried to do on October 1st a few years ago, but didn't really take off. And then I thought, well, you know, have a petition, get the town government to make it illegal to compact food, that kind of thing. And the reason I chose October 1st was two reasons. One, Clinton signed the Good Samaritan Act on October 1st of 1996. So there's this urban myth that you can't share food that you'll be sued. You know, it turns out there's a law that's been renewed a number of times where it's not legal to, you're protected by federal law from being sued if you donate food to feed the homeless. So that is no, and actually there's a legal team at Bolt Hall or at UC Berkeley School of Law who actually did research, and they found out that there has never been a store sued for donating food that then made somebody ill and then they got sued. That's actually an urban myth that's never happened. And there's actually a really cool website, which if people email me, keith@foodnotbombs.net, I can probably find it and email it to you, about studies by I think the University of Alabama and so on. So anyway, there's been a number of studies in the United States showing that at least 45% of the food that is grown here is thrown away before it ever gets to the table. And, you know, that's a huge amount of resources that are, you know, imagine all the work that it takes. I mean, just to do my garden of 1 acre in Taos, is such a huge amount of work. It's insane. I can't. I'm always impressed by Route One Farms or any of these organic farms that actually grow so much food they could actually sell it to, you know, grocery stores. It's impressive. So, you know, it just seems heartbreaking to throw that away and not use it, not make it either into compost or, considering that thousands of people are going hungry, millions. There's like 3 million, 4 million Americans living on the streets that could use a meal. So it could use a much better meal than what they often get with sugar, donuts, and all that stuff. So, you know, I think that's definitely something that we can work on as a society, is to end the throwing away of perfectly wonderful, edible, organic produce.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know that Arya's wife, Wendy, may have a question. Wendy, are you still on the call?
I'm still here. Thank you for calling me. I'm just so impressed with Keith's work and focus on abundance and not scarcity. And so I'm wondering, Keith, are you also reaching people on a different end of the political spectrum, people who have very different, you know, politics than you do, but are they getting your message and connecting with your message?
Absolutely. So, for instance, I would say, you know, we are left compassionate anarchists, a lot of us, at least the 8 of us that started it, Food Not Bombs. And so one day I get a call. I'm in St. Petersburg, Florida, with Food Not Bombs there. And they say, there's a protest downtown. You've got to go. They're protesting the law against feeding the hungry outside. So we rush down there, and there's this fancy tent that says Libertarian Party of Florida. Now, they're giving out hot dogs and Coca-Cola and stuff, but they were totally, once they came to our table, they completely agreed with why is the, you know, all this money going to war, and can't we do something better in our community. So they have like a different political perspective, and they were very patriotic and you know, not exactly like the way we would be, but we resonated on a number of different issues and connected. And I find that is frequently the case, that Republicans often like the idea that we DIY is very big for them, oddly enough. It kind of goes with little government, do it yourself, pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of philosophy. But then the persistence of this and the connection of this and the fact that we are real really touches them. So we do have a huge connection. And I think it's a little kind of interesting that the most liberal cities in the United States are the ones that have arrested us. So, for instance, two of the most liberal cities in Florida who waged the largest campaign against Food Not Bombs have been Orlando and Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, and also Gainesville has tried to stop us. And these are like really the core of the progressive, you know, city governments in Florida. And the same, you would think San Francisco and Santa Cruz and Santa Monica and Venice, those towns would be really sympathetic to Food Not Bombs, but they actually have not. So it's an interesting thing. The average people in America, no matter what their political background are, can see the logic of feeding people, can see the logic of not spending all of our resources on war, can see the logic of, there's intersections frequently with many, many people of all kinds of political backgrounds that, we had like a fundamentalist born-again Christian city councilor in Houston come out and risk arrest with us when the city government was threatening to arrest Food Not Bombs. She was so upset. And it was her involvement that actually turned the tide in that, and the city government, they passed a law restricting us, but they never enforced it because it was such there became a left-right alliance that was so strong that they didn't dare go after us there.
That's so interesting how the political situation can influence what the way that you're received in just kind of counterintuitive ways. And yet at the same time, people in every location always have this kind of deep resonance at the heart level.
Absolutely. You can't come up to Food Not Bombs and see all the people there and end up, you know, I've heard this many, many times. People go, oh, we're going down the street and we could see this group of people. And we knew before we saw the banner and the flyers that it was Food Not Bombs because of the energy, because there's this equalness. The people that there isn't a we are the people helping you. It's the we are all in this together energy. Just, you know, goes out into the community before anyone even gets to the Food Not Bombs table. And I think that resonates with all kinds of people for sure.
Absolutely. Keith, I had a question. I'm curious about if, kind of getting back to the theme of like community that starts and is embedded in all of your work, I'm curious if you have any stories of how kind of the fellowship and the space around the food that you've shared with people living on the streets has actually helped them to sort of get off the streets. And I know that we heard from Poncho, who was fed many times by Food Not Bombs volunteers at People's Park, but I think I'm referring more to people who are homeless and often end up that way because the community, which is sort of the safety net that would prevent them from otherwise ending up on the streets, is somehow not there. Is there a story of how this, or do you have a story rather, of how this work has kind of brought people back into being in homes?
Absolutely. There's a number of them. Maybe the starkest was that there was a couple who the young man had been a stockbroker at the Pacific Stock Exchange, and he got involved in cocaine so he could be more effective until he just went off the deep end and ended up on the streets. And so he lived with his partner on the streets for a number of years and ate at Food Not Bombs. And there became a tent city protest against anti-homeless laws. And they started coming and cooking with us and sharing food with us and coming to our meetings and having input in the meetings. And they ended up, instead of feeling horrible about themselves, and they stopped, you know, they became clean and sober. They started doing their own actions. They created their own, homeless rights group. And then before long, one of the guys, Bob, got a job at Tenderloin Housing. His partner got a job as a chef at a local, in a restaurant, and then became the chef in the restaurant. They rented an apartment in San Francisco. Before long, they actually bought a house in San Francisco.
Wow.
Not long after that, they ended up moving to the Big Island, and they have a house there, and they retired, and they have a pension and so on. So they went way from being on the streets to that. There's a lot of similar stories, but I'm very close to them, and so that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, and cocaine is no easy drug to get off, so that's quite a remarkable story. As the host, it's my privilege to ask you a final question we love to give to all of our guests, which is, how can we as a larger service-based community support your work?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, right now, there's a couple of things. The main thing is we're volunteer-based. So if you have time to volunteer with your local Food Not Bombs group or to start a local Food Not Bombs group, that would be huge. If you don't have the time for that, but you have some resources, you can help, connect us to sources of food being discarded or, locations of, donations of rice or cooking equipment, things like that. Or you can contribute online. And right now I'm actually trying to raise a bit of money to pay for the, for instance, the radio transmitter to go to send to Standing Rock. And we're trying to get a bit of money more for some more resources out there. And so then on occasion, of course, we actually did a lot of work recently over in Indonesia and the Philippines on some cyclone relief, that kind of thing. So you can go online to foodnotbombs.net and do the donation button and donate. And obviously, making a monthly donation online is a super big help. So that is one way. But really, it's about getting out on the streets with us and helping us cook the food, collect the food, and share the food. That's the fundamental thing. So volunteers are always like, the more volunteers, the more groups we have in the world, the more this message can get out. And, other things, like, for instance, if you have access to free printing, we can use that, particularly if it's like soy ink and it's on recycled paper. That really, really helps us, access to solar cells, that would be really helpful.
Keith, I'm wondering, we'll definitely send out the Food Not Bombs link to all the folks on the call, and if there's a needs list or something, we can add that as well, just so that people are fully updated. I think what strikes me most about listening to you speak is that it feels like there's so little gap between when you feel you come across a good idea and you're sort of enthusiastic, wholehearted, putting it into practice. And I think that's such a truly rare thing that would make a really beautiful world if we all practiced it. So thank you so much for being here today. The way we like to end calls, I just wanted to give everyone the opportunity to say thank you, Keith, on the count of three. So, 1, 2, 3. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you for you. That's beautiful, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. That's wonderful.
Big hug to you, Keith.
Yeah. Yeah, come and hug me in Santa Cruz at the post office every Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, lunch at the post office.
Thank you all.
Thanks for having me in such a wonderful program. And the website is just amazing. The websites I saw surrounding this are so beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.